This is On Our Campus, a kind of company production. On Our Campus is a podcast dedicated to exposing corruption, discrimination, and misconduct in public higher education. Welcome back to On Our Campus. This is episode 2 of this new podcast, On Our Campus, where we meet to discuss corruption in higher education. And this season, season 1, my co-host is Suzette Grelot, and my name is Marty Piercy, and we are talking specifically about the University of Oklahoma. Hello, Suzette. It's good to see you again.
Hi, Marty. Thanks.
I'm glad that you're here. We've been collaborating for a little bit on this podcast, and we have a team. It's not just the two of us. There are several of us involved, and in fact, today we will have one of those teammates joining us after the break. But I wanted to start by sort of reaching back to episode 1. We're going to start playing a little game called Connecting the Dirty Dots. And so I'm going to ask Suzette to kick off today's episode with some dot connecting.
Well, we think it's important that with each episode, we kind of reach back to that previous episode and, as Marty said, connect the dirty dots so that people can kind of see what we're trying to highlight here in our efforts. So from the first episode, we heard Renzi Stone, a member of the OU Board of Regents, say that the regents despised how Bourne operated, that the culture that he created was a disaster, and that his executive searches were fake. So now let's connect that to what's going on now. All the people that he refers to all still remain in power at the University of Oklahoma.
Correct.
And they actually have empowered a Bourne protege, Joe Harris, as interim president. So he despised how Bourne operated. He acknowledges the regents thought that Bourne was a disaster and that all of his executive searches were fake, and yet they continue down this particular path. So that's one dirty dot that I think we need to connect. Another is that Renzi acknowledges that Kyle Harper's search for provost was a sham, and that before the search even began, he was told that instructed, I think Renzi says, I was instructed that we're looking for someone a lot like Kyle Harper. And before that search was even over, Renzi was appointed to the Board of Regents, the OU Board of Regents. He was not a member of the Board of Regents when the search began. He was appointed to the Board of Regents as it was ending, and then he was present for the discussion of Kyle Harper's appointment at the Board of Regents meeting in March 2015. So these two dirty dots raise a number of questions and implications. What did the Board of Regents know about Bourne when they say he was a disaster, that his culture was a disaster, that they despise the way he operates? What all did they know about his behavior? Because again, remember, this conversation with Renzi took place months before Bourne's sexual misconduct was raised publicly.
Right.
So what all did they know, and why on earth would they go back to a Bourne protege if they thought Bourne was a disaster and wanted somebody who was not tainted by Bourne?
Yeah.
The other thing in terms of implications is, was there a quid pro quo for Renzi Stone when he was instructed to look for somebody like Kyle Harper as provost, and then he becomes a member of the Board of Regents shortly thereafter? Could we potentially argue that he found the provost that he was instructed to look for, and he was rewarded with a position on the Board of Regents? So these are important questions and implications that I think come out of that conversation that we had and connecting those dirty dots.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I should say, oh boy, it doesn't make any sense at all. But yes, it does seem, at least on the surface, to the casual observer, even to somebody who's not looking deeply into this, it seems like really problematic, right? Like it
really problematic.
Seems really dirty. Well, I think that's a pretty good recap of where we've been so far. And in the week since our first episode became public, we've gotten a lot of feedback, and it's been great. We've been getting some real encouragement. We've gotten some really excellent coverage in the news. We've heard from friends, family, and strangers, as well as some colleagues about this. And I really want I know that Suzette, you brought some feedback specifically from 2, 3, 4, 5 people, And so I want to hear a little bit of that. We've just got a couple of pull quotes from the first two, but we've heard from 2 alumni. We've heard from more people.
We've heard from a number of people. We're just going to offer some commentary that came from certain people as an example of the kind of reaction that we've received.
Exactly right. So first, I want to hear you pulled some quotes from a couple of alumni of the University of Oklahoma. Right. I'd love to hear those.
Well, let me just first add to Marty that not only did we hear from OU alums, students, faculty, and staff, we heard from staff and faculty at OCU and UCO that are concerned about corruption on their campuses. And we aren't there yet. As we've said before, we aren't going to go down the path of other universities yet, although we will at some point. But it is interesting that and sad, actually, that these are the kinds of things that other campuses experience. But on the OU front, we did hear from a couple of alums, several actually, but here are just some examples of a couple of things. One wrote to me to say thank you for the podcast, because this person suggested that their time at OU proved that everything was stacked against those who were not privileged white and male, and that had to change. So, an OU alum recognizing that that this validated their experience, that everything was stacked against people who weren't connected in some way, shape, or form, weren't privileged in some way, shape, or form at the University of Oklahoma. Another alum writes to me and says that the corruption reeks terribly and can only be remedied by removing all of the people who were in Boren's orbit. This person goes on to say, and quite frankly, Rinzai Stone proudly proclaiming how the regents all knew about the problems, thus, as we've said repeatedly, means that they actively did nothing for years, that this is a gross dereliction of duty, coming again from an OU alum the University of Oklahoma.
That's a pretty damning indictment, and I think in no way unfair.
I think this is exactly our point, yes. Right? Is that the regents failed in their job to supervise the president and failed the public trust. And so I think that this alum is indicating exactly that in their response. We also received a response from former staff members at the University of Oklahoma. And this, quite frankly, is a bit heartbreaking. One former staff member wrote to us and actually started off the conversation with to be honest, there was a time when I was, like following you, meaning me, saying that, can't she just let this go? But then this person listened to the podcast and said, now I get it. You have my support for exposing the corruption. I witnessed a lot of it in my time at OU. I kept my mouth shut. I worked 12-hour days, giving all I could to the university that I loved. I watched as male colleagues with no credentials and no interviews be promoted to posts with high pay. I watched my office have to contend with, and I'm air quoting now, priorities made by central administration, and how they would spend exorbitant amounts of money on consultants and outside companies to do projects that made absolutely no sense. It ultimately led me to leave OU, and this is the sad part. This person left OU because of this and says that they are now so happy to have found an employer that actually cares about me and my work. So this person asks us to keep fighting, keep exposing, and do not let anyone silence us. So
that's dope.
Beyond former employees, former OU students, so the alums and a former staff member, we've also heard from current students and current faculty.
Yeah.
And they really indicate their concerns about what's happening at the University of Oklahoma, but also indicating, you know, their fear and concerns about speaking up. But a current student, this is just one of the messages I received, thanked us for standing up for students in higher ed. This student says, after the years I've spent in undergrad at OU, it is relieving to feel that there is finally faculty on our side. I also wanted to reach out to you to see what students can do to push the administration to be more transparent and ethical in its practices. Many students like myself are fed up with the university playing games and constantly letting us down.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's a current student
at OU. That is troubling. Now, I've heard the feedback we're going to get next, but I would say this is painful to hear because it's a current student. This is a young person who is engaged in their community in a way that you only really engage in your community when you're a college student. You know, that's a powerful experience to try to sum up and gosh, I love so much that this person asks, what can I do? And I think one thing is we're working on a checklist that we will distribute around campuses and online about how to, you know, like the people in charge of systems that are corrupt are very good at gaslighting us. They're very good at pretending that nothing is wrong and convincing us that it's in our heads. And so we're going to make a checklist of how to identify corruption happening around you, how to recognize and call out a culture of corruption, right? That's something that Suzette's been working on and some of our other teammates and collaborators have been working on, and we're going to distribute that. And I want to thank you, listener, who wrote that feedback to us, thank you so much for asking that super important specific question, what can I do? And I don't want you to think that is one of the goals of this project, is to empower you students and faculty members, staff members, and community members outside of the school to push back against that corruption. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is... You know, it saddens me so much that we have students, faculty and staff and others in the community that feel like they, you know, that are even having to deal with these things at all.
Right.
That they're having to even take the time out of their day to write such a message that this person's a student and should be focusing on schoolwork. You know, the faculty members that wrote to us, they should be focusing on their work. They should not be having... So it's, again, it reflects one of the costly nature, that one of the costs that comes with corruption.
Sure.
The costliness of corruption, because
it
not only, you know, costs us money, it costs us time, and it costs us in terms of our morale.
Yes.
And so, you know, just constantly referring back to, you know, these are real costs to corruption.
Yes.
And yeah, Marty, I mean, the big thing is that we're not here just to shine light on corruption and, you know, expose what's happening in order to hold people accountable, but it's also about providing people practical outlets for, doing something about it. And, you know, because we shouldn't have to do anything about it,
right?
But if we don't do anything about it, then obviously we continue to suffer.
That's really powerful stuff from that student. That really moves me. And just to wrap up this bit on feedback from people, I wanna read a message we got from a current faculty member. This person says, "Your work on this podcast has brought light into the darkness. I learned so much listening to these yesterday. As someone pretty near the bottom of the ladder, I've been troubled by how the things that happen at an administrative level have always been shrouded in mystery, and one could sense the corruption without actually seeing it. The questionable appointments of questionable men for all those years left me feeling deeply disenchanted with OU's culture. I don't know what hope there is for true reform, but you've brought some. This work has real power, and furthermore, it is empowering." that is, Suzette, I know that's got to be for somebody who is in faculty at OU still, having dealt with all that you've dealt with since 1999, that's got to be pretty painful, really, to hear, like, this sort of struggling from the inside kind of feeling.
Yeah, it's painful. I'm sitting here feeling really emotional about it because, I mean, this is a reflection of my experience for years, and it hurts deeply to, you know that other people are feeling the same way. And I know it's the motivating thing we need, but it's just sad and mm-hmm. it hurts, mm-hmm. To know that this is how people feel at their institution of higher education, which, you know, I just feel so strongly in the value of higher education and it's, what it does to liberate people. Mm. And yet what we've seen happen here is this is not liberating. This is the opposite of that.
Yes. This is a binding up. I agree. Recognizing, as Emiliano Zapata said, that, like, if you've come to help because you know that your liberty is bound up with my own, then come and join me. But if you've come to help, if you've come to fix things, then you can go back, right? Like, we're here to join with each other in the spirit of collaboration and to encourage these people. The folks who have written, and thank you so much, first of all, for your feedback. And I want to encourage you to be brave. I know it is challenging, and you don't have to be brave in the sense of dropping a demand for a resignation in the lap of, the current interim president of the university.
A fucking resignation.
Of asking for his fucking resignation. You don't have to be that bold. You don't have to do anything in this life, but I do hope that you discover your agency in encountering this kind of these types of shenanigans, this sort of skullduggery, and these things should not be shrouded in mystery. And let me tell you, as somebody who did not attend that school, but somebody who is a resident of Oklahoma and a taxpayer in Oklahoma, and somebody who is deeply invested in equity, as I said last week, I am furious, I say, that some of the goings-on of this school have been hidden. I think chartering private planes for travel to football games. I think land acquisitions that are shady as fuck, like all of these things. This burns my ass because I care about Oklahoma. I care about Oklahomans. I care about people who are vulnerable. And if you think school funding is not high enough, then I want you to think about the money that has just been set on fire by the powerful administrative figures at the University of Oklahoma, and think about how many kids in Oklahoma don't have new textbooks. Yeah, because that's that same pool of money coming in and out of that, right? So, and let me just get off my soapbox for a minute, and let's get back to what we're talking about. This is important. I really do appreciate y'all reaching out, and I hope that you will continue to. We've heard from people from other schools, like Suzette said, and we want to get all of this stuff in as much as we can.
I mean, I've heard from people around the country, you know, people who know me and people who don't, and right. are paying attention to what's happening here, and are just kind of like, literally, like, you know, just what the hell is going on at the University of Oklahoma, and are just kind of aghast at the audacity of this Board of Regents and the university's leadership, and then are also asking, I think, really important questions about their own campuses and
sure.
you know, and the value of their own institutions of higher education. So this is a much bigger issue than what we're dealing with here. But yeah, I just want to add to your comment, Marty. You know, I want to thank all those who've reached out to us and have provided their support and shared their stories. And that's really what we're here for. We're here to help amplify those voices but also to protect them because, I mean, almost everyone who wrote to us, you know, also expressed their fear and concern about doing so. And
absolutely.
And I think that leads us into perhaps, you know, some of our conversation to come up regarding the culture of fear and secrecy.
That's, yeah, exactly right. I am not an employee of the University of Oklahoma. I never have been. And guess what's going to happen now? I'm never going to be. I will definitely never get hired by the University of Oklahoma after this. But yeah, we've been talking for the last couple of weeks about what a culture of fear and this culture of silence. And shortly we're going to take a break. And after that break, one of our team members is going to join us. But for now, I want to focus on you have had this experience and you have stood up in the face of it. You're tougher than most, somehow. I don't know where this reserve well of bravery comes from in your experience, but you have stood up to former President Boren. You've stood up to Renzi Stone on the Board of Regents, other regents, the provost of the school, which we are, by the way, definitely going to get into some of that in future episodes, a little bit in this episode, but in future episodes, definitely going to talk about the problematic provost, as you so cleverly put it. What was the straw that broke the camel's back for you that made you say, no, I'm done with this silence, I'm done with this, I'm stepping out from behind this veil, like, why is that? Because I know it's not easy, as we've heard from this feedback. Everybody that we've talked to that is currently associated with the school, and a lot of people who aren't anymore are saying, I'm not brave enough yet. And that I respect that. I understand it. But what do you think it was for you?
Well, I can pinpoint the date in 2016. There is a substantial story that goes along with that, that perhaps we'll talk to. We'll speak more specifically to on a future episode. But there was a moment. I mean, it was kind of a building thing, you know, as I was being exposed to what was happening behind closed doors. It was building. But there was a particular decision that was made by then President Boren in 2016 that was, it kind of made me go, this is the end of things for me here, mm-hmm. and kind of set the stage for my, you know, continued persistence on the inside and now on the outside. I appreciate again, Marty, your comments about what I've done, and I just want to reiterate again that it's you know, what upsets me so much are the things that, you know, everyone has had to deal with at OU, and so when we go to talk about some of those specifics, and those are coming, they're coming very soon. They'll make some sense as to like, yeah, that there were a lot of other people that at that same time in 2016, something happened, and it was kind of like, you know, a lot of us were done. It's like no more Kool-Aid, you know, after this particular decision. So I look forward to discussing that. You know, until then, I can just say that, you know, it's been tough for a lot of people at the university. Mm-hmm. It's been tough for a lot of people who are just trying to you know, carry on every day and do their jobs with integrity. And so the hope is that this project and others will make that easier for them. Because it will be harder for the administration, whoever remains in the administration, that it will be harder for them to continue to operate the way that they do.
I think you're right, and I think that's we had a good conversation yesterday about setting goals for this season of this podcast, and also for our team here. Our first of all, obviously, we're here to provide information and exposure, But also, yeah, what we want to do, a big part of what we want to do is we want to empower people to speak up because of this culture of silence and fear. I think we need to take a break here for a minute. And when we come back, we'll be joined by another team member. And as we go to break, I just want to encourage you, the listener, pause your podcast because there's not going to be an advertisement in between these segments. I want you to pause your podcast for a minute and just think about what that means in your life to be brave about the systems of oppression that are surrounding you, what you're participating in, what you're not participating in, and how you can individually, personally contribute to dismantling those systems of oppression. I know that's a big order. Just think about that for a minute because we're going to come back and we're going to talk some more about institutional fear. And I think this is a valuable conversation. So take a minute to think about that and we'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back. I hope that was a peaceful and informative break for you. I hope that you took some time to examine some of the systems that surround you. I certainly did, but I also took some time to have some laughs with my friends and collaborators. We have a good time
and
here.
And we cry.
We do. It's true.
Marty and I cry.
Yeah, well, yeah. Not me. I'm a tough, very masculine man. No, so yeah. So welcome back, and we're going to now introduce one of our teammates, one of our collaborators. This is a friend of mine who you have probably heard of. It's my friend Jess Eddy, and he made the very difficult choice and very courageous choice to come forward with accusations of inappropriate behavior on the part of former president of the University of Oklahoma, David Boren. Now, that is not what we are here to talk about, but we will certainly talk about that. But I want to introduce our friend Jess, because Jess is an invested stakeholder and is somebody who worked in the president's office for a long time. And so Jess has some insight, I think, to share that is very important in this specific conversation for this episode. And so, Jess, thank you for joining us here on the podcast. And full disclosure, Jess has been involved quite a bit in our planning and in our team meetings about what we're going to talk about. Jess has been present and has contributed a great deal. He's a collaborator, like I said, with us. So I want you to know that. Jess, thank you for coming.
Thanks, Marty. Really happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you're here. And we were talking before the break about this culture of silence and of fear on the campus. And I know that you're not the perpetrator of that fear, but you've A, experienced that fear, and B, been put into a position as a tool of that culture. And so I wanted us to include you in this conversation because you have insight that Suzette wouldn't have, and that certainly I wouldn't have. Suzette's probably been on the receiving end of some of that. But let's talk a little bit about that. Suzette, do you want to get that started with Jess?
Well, I think that one of the things that, what kind of jokes that we had, I guess, in terms of how to deal with some of the issues we dealt with at the University of Oklahoma, was this concept of the dreaded call from Evans Hall. And, you know, deans and administrators and others around campus would kind of joke about this as like, just whatever you do, don't do something that will lead to the dreaded call from Evans Hall. That's the kind of fear that we had about the leaders at Evans Hall. That's the you know, reflection of a very authoritarian regime at a university that you would be so afraid of receiving a phone call from the president's office or the provost's office, you know, in my case as well, that you had to just, were constantly always on, walking on eggshells, I guess, about, you know, what you were doing, about your job. And again, there are costs to that. There are costs associated, opportunity costs and other costs associated with constantly being afraid of what you say and what you do and how you represent your work. You know, I mean, we couldn't just come to work and just do our work, you know, with integrity and just, you know, if you stepped out of line or whatever, if there was that perception, then, you know, you had a conversation, but it was just a tremendous amount of fear. And I think Jess experienced that directly when he was a part of the President's Action Line, which is interesting, right? That you have students working on the President's Action Line, and what happens when somebody comes through the President's Action Line? I received emails, phone calls from people, you know, working on the President's Action Line saying, oh dear, somebody complained about you or your study abroad or whatever it was. Yeah. And the kind of, you know, so-called accountability, it wasn't really that. So I think Jess can give us some more insight to this whole notion that we were just terrified at all turns as to, you know, what we were saying and what we were doing and how we were having to function on a daily basis.
Yeah. I mean, that culture of fear is palpable. And we're talking from my experiences there, 2010, 11, 12-ish time period. And, you know, as a 21-year-old kid, I didn't realize what was going on fully then in terms of the culture that David Bourne perpetuated at OU to, you know, achieve and do things his way. But I certainly was a cog in that machine there in the President's Action Line. And while it didn't dawn on me until years later, really, when I came back to OU as an adult and could kind of see the consequences of running an administration that way. And I would characterize that way as relational nepotism. And simply, if Bourne liked you, you were just powerful beyond measure. It didn't matter if you were right or wrong on an issue. It didn't matter about your merits or whatever. It was just, if he liked you, you just had a lot of power. And so that really even trickled down to a bunch of kids on this President's Action Line.
Yeah.
And I was a particularly unqualified kid to have any power. At the time, I was a staggering alcoholic. I was, just an emotional wreck. I was just still reeling from the traumatic experiences with David Bourne at the time, and really just a mess. But I would remember we'd get these calls, and they'd range from someone calling about the trees need to be watered, all the way to a parent calling about some professor's comments to their child or wanting to overload a class. And, you know, I remember to get advised to just solve problems, fix things, and free reign. And I mean, I called dozens of professors and, you know, I had complete discretion and exercised complete discretion to do things that I didn't have any understanding of the consequences or the context of what I was doing. Hey, you know, I remember very vividly, and there's some, you know, shame in this, but I remember very vividly the way, you know, serious, thoughtful, professional adults that I'd get on the phone or get an email, the way they'd perk up. Mm-hmm. And I did not understand how wrong that was then.
Simply because you were calling on behalf of the President's Action Line, that they would perk up and recognize, oh my gosh, you know, the President's office, an undergraduate from the President's office is calling with some sort of authority to, I mean, this was so embedded in our daily lives. It's just really mind-boggling.
Well, let me ask, because I I wasn't in either of your positions. Was this something, okay, so this is an undergraduate, like you said, calling from the president's office. That would seem to me, if I was receiving that call, I feel like I would, in my head, I would respond, ah, shit, not only am I in trouble, but I'm so unimportant, right, that the president's having like some jackass kid call me, like, this is great. I'm in the principal's office, only it's not the principal, it's his TA or whatever. You know what right. I'm saying? Like, is that accurate?
Well, it's kind of like this, and this is actually lends to the term lack of institutional control, which is just OU in general. But the president wouldn't even know, you know. I mean, we were just set loose. A bunch of kids in a room.
They were just empowered.
They were just empowered. We were just given this license to do these things.
On behalf of the president of the university.
So there's a little bit of me that's like, well, anarchy is good, right? But, like, this is the tyranny of masses is what this sounds like. Instead of these students of the school are running the show, it's like a few students, like, yeah, being empowered, but in this way that's really super toxic sounding.
Well, because it comes with, as Jeff started out saying, it comes with the if Boren selected you, you were a chosen one, then it would resonate, right? And so, right. I mean, along those lines, as I get into our little mini-series that we're going to do soon, as Marty alluded to earlier, a little mini-series on the problematic provost, is that he was one of those young people on campus. You know, when I first heard and met Kyle Harper, he was, you know, he was an assistant professor. He was, you know, a faculty member, but he was being lined up for powerful things. And I had to learn that, you know, like everybody else did, but he was somebody that was empowered to make other people scared. Mm-hmm. It did make other people afraid of what he was going to say and do. And so these young students that are sitting there on the president's action line basically had some free rein to go and make people afraid of what the president would do if he had to get involved.
And if you don't think that David Boren didn't do that by design, you know, a lot of people talk about how Donald Trump likes to make his people below him fight, and, you know, and that kind of deal, like that as a leader. Something that I absolutely, utterly do not understand, but David Boren and Donald Trump had that in common. Mm. He would create those situations between his vice presidents, but he would created that at OU where it was, you know, he wanted people to know these were his guys, these were his favorites. Fall in line, and if you don't, you're going to get dealt with just like D.C., you know? I mean, it was a D.C. culture of political nepotism. You know, I like this person for reasons that have nothing to do with why they're in this job.
But interestingly, you know, this is exactly what I saw, was that there were these empowered Boren guys, or what we call Boren boys. But then he also, and it was explained to me by a member of the Boren boys, how Boren also then cultivated this competition among the Boren boys, so that he would kind of pit them against each other. So as somebody who was a Boren boy told me, he said that there's this Boren boys team and this Boren boys team and this Boren boys team. So that way, you know, none of the Boren boys were actually on each other's teams, you know, that Boren would pit them against each other so that they wouldn't collaborate with one another.
They couldn't collude to undermine the president.
It was fascinating. And the fact that you know, somebody in that circle actually recognizes that, said to me, I see what's happening here, but was in the midst of it. And, you know, wasn't able to break out of that atmosphere.
Wow.
And let me say right real quick here, you see now some of those born boys still at OU, and you see some of them that aren't.
There's many of them that are still there, and some that got out or into other positions. It's like it's an ongoing saga, you know, in terms of who's been empowered and who's still in place.
Well, it demands of me that I ask, again, do you think that your experiences are common among other members of that group of people that Bourne gave power to? Do you think that is a common experience of those folks? Like Kyle Harper is a good example. I'm asking your opinion, your vibe, honestly, right, about this.
You know, I appreciate the deference you give me in answering it, because it is a difficult question. I got to base it on my knowledge of David Bourne, personally, my experiences, and then, you know, my knowledge that I gained from talking to other victims of his and at OU. And, you know, the answer to the best answer to the question is that I understand that David Bourne has been mixing extramarital relationships and his professional life in the abuse of power since the mid to late 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know, I'm not going to say that, you know, every person David Bourne put in a position of power had an inappropriate element to it, but I am going to say that a lot of them did.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a guy like me who was 21 years old, who was really not in any shape to be having any authority or delegated to him whatsoever. If you play that pattern out further and you look at some vice presidents, a provost at the University of Oklahoma without any of the credentials to get that position, and then you take a look back at what their past was and their closeness and their relationship, just from the outside looking in, at those individuals, you know, I don't have to draw the conclusion. I think history will.
That's really that's a good way to put that too. Because the last thing I want to do is to accuse a survivor of abuse of, you know, in any way welcoming that abuse or of profiting from that abuse. But payola exists, correct? And so, you know, sometimes mitigating those circumstances with a benefit is the easier route to take. And let me say, this is a phrase I texted to the entire team last week. I just had this thought that, you know, we often say that hurt people, right? Like, I've been traumatized and I will create trauma. I think that corrupt people. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And this sounds like some of these quotes from the provost, Kyle Harper, such as...
Are you an advocate for international studies?
I'm a huge advocate for international studies, whether it should be a separate college or not. I'm willing to take a look at the various possibilities and think about what's the best where in the institution.
You know, there's a chain of command. I'm your boss. I'm responsible for you. Is that clear?
Whether you agree or disagree, you have to help us do this. And
those quotes have the sound of somebody who has been groomed to be corrupt by a corrupt leader. That's to me as an outsider.
Well, it definitely raises questions about several things regarding his own experience, and particularly potential motivations for why he would be doing these sorts of things, why he would be telling me, putting me in positions where I felt defensive and concerned and fearful. You know, and it's really a perpetuation of that culture of fear that he was raised up in
right.
at the University of Oklahoma.
Well, I think it's important for us to note that, as was just indicated to you, through your very own ears, we do have some, I would say, some pretty indicative language recorded from Provost Kyle Harper. And we are going to dive deep into that in a series of episodes in this season of this podcast about this very problematic provost. For now, I think that we should probably think about drawing to a close. I do want to thank you, Jess, for bringing your particular insight to this conversation. Jess will be back in future episodes to talk about more. And I just want to, I take a lot of time to voice my respect for Suzette. Jess, this is not easy. I understand, as somebody who has been, who has survived various kinds of trauma. I love and respect you so much for being brave enough to, I don't want to get too emotional, but like for being brave enough to talk about these really difficult things. Just like I respect Suzette for talking about this really difficult experiences. Thank you so much for coming and sharing some of this with us.
No, thank you so much, Marty. You know, and I know I speak for and with Suzette on this matter of people such as yourselves and the team here, new family that have rushed around us to support us in the ways in which you just did, and how critical that is for us to continue to engage these immensely powerful people and institutions, and particularly the depravity therein, mm-hmm. The lack of humanity, of morality. It's scary. It's scary. And without, you know, people such as yourselves, you know, you don't get through this. And I think that, to reiterate what you guys have said before, that's why we're here. That's why this team exists. This podcast exists. That's a big part of our lives now, is to be what you have been for us, to everyone else. 'Cause we know, to all you students, faculty, and staff at the University of Oklahoma, that the prospect of speaking your truth to that power is just daunting and overwhelming. It's tough, and we want you to know that we're here. We understand, and we love you.
That's a good word. That's a good word. Before we leave, Suzette, do you have anything more that you want to add for today?
This has been a really difficult and emotional episode mm-hmm. for, I think, me and many of us sitting here in this room, and I think that'll happen again and again. And so I just want to thank you, Marty, for being our rock and the other members of our community. And Jess, of course, you know how I feel about you.
All the love.
So thank you, listeners, for joining us for this episode. And I hope you will continue to go with us on this journey. I hope that you will reach out and contact us. Our website is onourcamp.us. Our email address is connect@onourcamp.us. And you can, you know, most easily probably reach us on social media at onourcampus. And I really hope you will reach out to us. we are wrapping up the second episode, but I want you to know that the next episode is going to be a little different. Like, we're still going to be talking about the challenges of corruption at the University of Oklahoma, but what we're going to do is we're going to go back to the future. We're going to reach back to 1999 and see, we're going to take a little look, we'll dive into Professor Dr. Gralat's first day at the University of Oklahoma and find out what that experience was like and get some of her primary source history on starting work as a professor at the University of Oklahoma. Suzette, I'm so excited to get into that conversation.
I'm looking forward to it as well, Marty.
Well, thank you, Suzette. Thank you, Jess, for joining us. Thank you, Nate, for engineering this audio. And thank you to Kind of Company for producing this podcast. We will be back soon with episode 3. And for now, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you soon. Thanks. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Marty Piercy and me talk about issues of corruption among the administration at the University of Oklahoma. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. You can send us an email at connect@onourcamp.us, as well as follow and interact with us on Twitter and Instagram @onourcampus. We hope that you too are ready to eliminate systemic corruption in public higher education, as we all deserve better. For more information about this show and how you can get involved, visit us on the web at www.onourcamp.us. For Marty Piercy and everyone at On Our Campus, I'm Suzette Gralat.